By 1964, his name wasn't Cassius Clay anymore. He was going by Cassius X, and his hero was Malcolm X. By 1965-66, his name was Muhammad Ali, and his hero would have been Elijah Muhammad of the Nation of Islam. But by 1968, when his title was stripped, when he was banned from boxing, when he was losing all his money hand over fist, and when he was really alone in the world with the exception of his wife at the time, Belinda, he would have said that his heroes would have been the people.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. You may have heard of A People's History of the United States, but perhaps you haven't heard that its author, Howard Zinn, launched a series examining various aspects of U.S. history through a progressive lens. This week, author David Zirin reads from his contribution to the series. It's called A People's History of Sports in the United States. Even if you're not much of a sports fan, you may find this counter-narrative riveting. Zirin looks critically at important moments, movements, and figures in sports, with a particular focus on race, gender, and class. Of course. Zirin's written four books that examine the intersection of sports, politics, and culture from a left-leaning perspective. He's also the sports columnist for the magazine The Nation, the only dedicated sports columnist in its 150-year history. Zirin is a frequent newspaper columnist and guest on various talk shows, and he's got one of his own on XM Satellite Radio. This reading was recorded in October 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for everyone who's resisting the Redskins game right now. And I noticed there's a Boston Red Sox cap in the audience. I'm not sure why. Are they in the news these days? This is the book. And I wrote it for one reason and one reason only, and that's because I wanted to put an absolute stake into the heart of this idea that sports and politics somehow don't mix. And I could tell you from being a working sports writer that this is the insane fear of the people who control professional sports in our country, that you would dare have any kind of political analysis about the games that we play. I mean, they want their ESPN over here and their C-SPAN over there, their sports page over here, their front page over there, and heaven forfend if you dare try to say, well, gee, maybe there's a connection between the two. And we saw this in a big way just this past summer during the 2008 Olympics. I don't know if people heard about it, but there was some controversy about those games. Did people hear that? That there was a little bit of a buzz, tiny bit, yeah? Yeah, because they were in Beijing, and you know, even though they were in Beijing, and the General Electric and NBC wanted it to be just a nice, fun, magical tourist ride through Beijing, people started to raise questions like, weren't 2 million people displaced to make way for the Olympic facilities? And why is General Electric, which is broadcasting the games through NBC, also donating 300,000 closed-circuit cameras for the purpose of watching people in Beijing? Is that good? Is that fair? Is that right? And then what about China's dalliances with Darfur, with in terms of Tibet and the crackdown there? And you started to see even athletes and sports writers start to raise real political questions. And the response by the International Olympic Committee, headed by a gentleman by the name of Jacques Roger, was not to say, yeah, let's have a dialogue about this. Or, gee, maybe we should discuss the political implications of the games being in Beijing. No, the response by Jacques Roger was to say, politics and the Olympic movement must never be connected. That was Jacques Roger's comment. And granted, Jacques Roger is an athlete. You might not know this. He was on the 1968 Olympic team for Belgium in the sport of yachting. That's true. And that history has served him well. And one of the things that Jacques Roger was furious about to all his minions was to spread that message. We are not going to talk politics in these Olympic Games. Even though at the opening ceremonies you had George W. Bush, Henry Kissinger, and Vladimir Putin all in the same box, watching the games together, yet we're not allowed to talk about politics. I mean, it makes you wonder if Jacques Roger is allergic to irony or something. I mean, honestly, when he said that, I got a sort of a deja vu of Roger's statements about politics and the Olympics can't be together when, during the Russia-Georgia conflict, John McCain issued this statement where he said, in the 21st century, big nations must never invade smaller nations. And you're just sort of like, well, I agree, but really? You really going to go with that? Okay, that's cool. So it wasn't just Jacques Roger. I mean, Mike Krzyzewski, who's the coach of USA Basketball, also the coach at Duke, also known in these parts as the Antichrist. Mike Krzyzewski, when he got wind that a couple of the players on the team were starting to raise issues about China and militarism and whether they should say something in Beijing, big-time players like Kobe Bryant and LeBron James, Mike Krzyzewski said, "Athletes have no obligation, either present or historical, to be political." That was Mike Krzyzewski. But the best was, or the worst, was the head of the Canadian Olympic Committee, a gentleman, a very unfortunately named gentleman by the name of Dick Pound. That's his actual name. And I don't want to make fun of the man's name, but it is Dick Pound. And I actually was doing a radio show where I was talking about Dick Pound. This is a true story. And someone came in, one of the producers came in from the back room and said, "I don't think you can say that on the air." And I was like, no, that's really his name. But Dick Pound, at a meeting of all the Canadian Olympians, looked at them and he said, "If you can't keep your mouth shut in Beijing, then you might as well just stay home." And so there's this constant pressure on athletes, on sports writers, and on fans to not be political when it comes to sports. Yet, of course, when it comes to owners and, frankly, politicians, they're only too quick to use sports as a way to brand themselves as regular people. I mean, you see that in this presidential campaign so much. I mean, the reference to the hockey mom is something that's been very real. Or even just the past week with Sarah Palin dropping the puck at the Philadelphia Flyers game and then getting a hearty cheer, if you will, from the Philadelphia Flyers fans. I mean, was politics and sports coming together? And so you've seen it in the presidential campaign over and over again. I mean, Barack Obama shoots hoops in front of the troops. Joe Biden is a big college football fan. John McCain, I don't know what he does, really. Shuffleboard. I don't know what John McCain does. But he does. That's cheap. I'm sorry. But so you have all this sports and politics come together when it comes to politicians trying to use sports, but heaven forbid an athlete try to do the opposite. And the shame of that is that the tradition is very rich and the tradition is very real, and it's an exciting tradition and it's a hidden tradition, and I would argue that it's a radical tradition that tells us so much about this country. And I really wish we knew more about this tradition, because people might see the cover of the book. I was at a book tour event in Berkeley 2 weeks ago, and a young person who worked at the bookstore asked me how I got Barack Obama to pose for the cover. And that's true. That's true. And said to me, "Did you get him to pose, or was it like Photoshop?" And I was like, "No, it's Muhammad Ali, actually, but we could talk about that." Yeah. So it's a history that I think needs to be revived in a serious way. And I don't know if there are any teachers here, for example, but it's a fascinating way to look through the window of sports at the history in this country, particularly the history of struggle against oppression and the desire for people in this country, for marginalized people, to try to strive for full citizenship. I mean, one example of that in the book that I use is I constantly am going back to the position of women relative to sports from the time of, you know, people first coming to the United States to the present day. And if you look at the history of women relative to sports, it's actually a history of struggle. It's a history for access to the physical. It's a history of people actually fighting and striving for full citizenship, but it's also a history of backlash, and it's a history of hysteria and a history of fear on behalf of the powers that be in this country of the idea that women would dare engage in sports. I mean, the quack science that emerged in this country in the 18th century that coincided with the first real mass movement of women, in this case the suffragettes, fighting for the right to vote, was amazing how they would use sports as a way to sort of chop against women who were trying to fight for equal rights. I mean, it really is something. I mean, science was produced that said if women played sports that their uteruses would implode, that they would become infertile, that their sexuality would become distorted and destroyed, all for playing sports. And this was throughout society. I mean, I just want to read a quick example from the book. This is from the 1878 edition of the American Christian Review, which is diagramming the 12-step downfall of any woman who would dare engage in the sinful world of croquet. And you didn't know croquet was that dangerous, did you? All right, I'll just read them through quick. Step 1, a social party. Step 2, a social and play party. Step 3, a croquet party. Uh-oh. Step 4, a picnic and croquet party. Step 5, picnic, croquet, and dance. Step 6, absence from church. Step 7, imprudent or immoral conduct. Step 8, exclusion from the church. Step 9, more croquet. Uh-oh. Step 10, poverty and discontent. 11, shame and disgrace. And 12, ruin. and you thought it was just croquet. Now, the response to that was for a lot of the suffragettes to actually look at sports as a way where they were going to actually make their stand. And the bicycle actually became this very potent symbol for the suffragette movement. I mean, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, she said that when women finally win the right to vote, they're going to go to the polls riding on a bicycle. And this is what Susan B. Anthony said about the bicycle. She said, "Let me tell you what I think of bicycling. I think it has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. It gives women a feeling of freedom and self-reliance. I stand and rejoice every time I see a woman ride by on a wheel, the picture of free, untrammeled womanhood." And it was other things, too. I mean, the bicycle became this, like I said, a very potent and serious symbol for the fight for full citizenship and liberation. But also the mere aspect of play and the right to play became this place where they would make a stand. Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote an article in a women's magazine at the time called The Lily, which I cite in the book, which is really astounding. It's something that if it was produced today would, I think, cause palpitations among the people on ESPN and in the macho, testosterone-drenched world of sports radio, where she wrote an essay arguing that there is nothing biologically inherent in men being better athletes than women. And who's to say how great an athlete a woman could be if she was actually granted all the freedom of men when it comes to running, jumping, playing as young girls? I mean, she's putting this out as an argument, that it's actually a social construction, that it's oppression that's preventing women from reaching their athletic potential. And it's something that shocked the sports world at the time and the political world that surrounded the sports world. But they weren't so pristine then about separating those worlds between sports and politics. So it was something that was able to be discussed. But it's not just women. I mean, the history of African Americans in this country. I mean, looking at that history through the vantage point of sports is, you know, absolutely fascinating. I mean, because there's been a lot that's been on ESPN and on other and Disney has produced a whole series of movies that deal with the issue of racism in sports, but they tend to be dealt with in a way that's very, you know, Disney. I mean, Disney's become like an adjective. It's not just a company. I mean, they Disney-fy the history, and the history, no matter what particular aspect of the struggle, whether it's Jackie Robinson and the Brooklyn Dodgers or the Texas Western team in the 1960s that became the first all-African-American team to win the NCAA championship, which was made into a movie called Glory Road, the history tends to go in three steps. It's segregation, integration, celebration. Yay! And then everything's all good. Racism was conquered, and everybody now plays sports. And you know, that's the history. And the real history is actually much more interesting and tells us something much more concrete about this country. I mean, actually, because the first organized sports in this country, which really took place right after the Civil War, weren't segregated. They were integrated. Early baseball was integrated. Early horse racing. In 1875, the first Kentucky Derby, 16 of the 17 jockeys were African-American at the first Kentucky Derby. You know, this is obviously in Kentucky, so just food for thought. And this was the case across the sports spectrum, even more violent and brutal sports of the day, like you know, cockfighting and bare-knuckle boxing. These were integrated exercises. And you don't see segregation in sports until the defeat of Reconstruction in the 1870s, until the establishment of Jim Crow in the South. That's when you see the wholesale whitening of sport from one after the other. And it's really something, like when you look at how that whitening and how that segregation took place and how total and uniform it was across the country. Like a lot of the early Jim Crow laws had sections in it about sports and would have specific laws that were in the South that there could not be, you know, you could have a cockfighting match and two chickens could tear each other's heads off, but heaven forfend if one chicken was owned by a black person and one owned by a white person, you know. So the sport itself would be celebrated, but the integration was something that had to be fought against. I mean, keeping people apart by any means necessary. But like I mentioned the Kentucky Derby, 1875, 16 of the 17 jockeys are black. By 1890, it's all white. So it just it happened like that. You know, baseball, early African-American baseball players like Moses Fleetwood Walker were literally physically removed from the field. And there's one instance where Moses Walker, he has to brandish a gun on the field to get off in one piece because he actually feared for his life because they were saying, no, this is a white sport now. You're getting off the field. And this was something that of course, stayed in the nation's pastime until 1947, Jackie Robinson integrating Major League Baseball. And baseball took till 1959, Pumpsy Green, the Boston Red Sox, being the last team to integrate. So it's really quite something. So that's part of the history. But then there's this other part of the history, too, that's about sports becoming actually a vantage point or a stage of struggle that affected the nation like nothing else. I mean, because one sport, to give one example, one sport did stay integrated at this time, and that sport was boxing. I mean, boxing remained integrated. And, there are serious restrictions on the integration. I mean, for example, lack of access for African-American boxers to actually become champions. And there were several fighters who, as a rule, wouldn't fight black opponents. But the bigger vantage point, the bigger story, is that the people who controlled boxing, I mean, they weren't exactly the Quakers. You know, they weren't doing this because they believed in any sort of sense of racial justice. They did it because they thought themselves that it would be a terrific way to make money off the sport. You pit a black person against a white person, you create like this insane lynch mob atmosphere in the stands, and the money rolls in. Now, a person came in who kind of upset the apple cart, and that was a person by the name of Jack Johnson. And Jack Johnson, a lot of young people today know him as this sort of insipid folk singer, guy named Jack Johnson. I'm not a big fan of him, but I like the first Jack Johnson a lot more. And it's so interesting, like Jack Johnson wins the title, and there came this unholy call for a great white hope to go against Jack Johnson, to restore order to the world. And a gentleman by the name of Jim Jeffries was goaded out of retirement to fight against Johnson, to, as one writer put it, to restore the dignity of the white race. And if people doubt that sports have any sort of political history, I mean, the comments by Jeffries and Johnson before the fight are so striking. Like, this is before the fight, this is what Jeffries says. He says, I'm coming out of retirement for one reason and one reason only, and that's to prove that the white man is better than the Negro. You know, that's his motivation for fighting. And Jack Johnson, what his response was, he was interviewed by the Dallas Morning News, which is hardly a liberal paper even today. And Jack Johnson said, "The tap of the gong will be like music to me. I cannot wait to step into the ring and prove that I am Jeffrey's master." Now, this is several decades after, obviously, the end of the Civil War. And the headline in the Dallas Morning News in a big font is, "Johnson says we'll be Jeffrey's master." Now, in the fight itself, Johnson just dominated Jeffrey's over the course of the fight, knocked him out. And even despite an atmosphere where the crowd was led in a sing-along of a song of the time called "All Coons Look Alike to Me," was that you have this whole crowd singing this, and Johnson steps in there. He could not be ruffled, and he just stepped in there and he knocked Jeffries out. But it's really the aftermath of the fight that I find so fascinating, because after the fight, you get this situation where you have this fear, anger, and violence develop among white pockets in different urban areas, and it attempts to enter black neighborhoods being fought back, which led, with a wildfire effect, to the widest spread of racial unrest that this country had ever seen on a national level or ever would see until the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. I mean, this happens after a boxing match, Jack Johnson and Jim Jeffries. I mean, it says something about what it meant. And I have this in the book, like all the spirituals developed in the South, like in praise of Jack Johnson. On chain gangs, people sang about Jack Johnson. It became so much more about who Jack Johnson was as an individual, but it was about what he represented. And you could say the same thing about after Johnson had his title stripped under circumstances I deal with in the book, under very dubious circumstances, where he was convicted under something called the Mann Act, which was about he brought a white woman across state lines who happened to be his wife for immoral purposes. And they were looking for a reason to take his title away. There wasn't another African-American champion again until Joe Louis, who was champion for a good period of the 1930s. And I actually interview in the book a sports writer who's still alive, the only living sports writer who was there at the Joe Louis fight, a gentleman by the name of Lester Red Rodney, who's 96 years old now, lives in Oakland, California, sharp as a tack. We should all be so lucky. And Lester Rodney wrote for the Daily Worker, which was the Communist Party's newspaper at that time. And it's so interesting to talk to Lester Rodney about the experiences of what he did. First of all, it was great to talk to him just because, I mean, he's this remarkable living link to that history. But it was also great because he was a cool guy. Like, and I told him that the book was coming out. He smiled and he said, "Ah, to be 80 again," which was kind of funny. But the better part about Lester Rodney than that is the stories about Joe Louis, the stories of meeting Joe Louis, the stories of what Harlem looked like after Joe Louis beat Max Schmeling, who was Hitler's favorite, who was allied with the Nazi Party, and he knocked Schmeling out. And after the fight, you just had this joy and celebration develop throughout Harlem. You had Richard Wright, the African American author, Native Son and Black Boy. Richard Wright wrote a song about Joe Louis that Count Basie put to music and that Paul Robeson performed. So you had this whole aspect of culture and resistance that went through Joe Louis. And so Joe Louis himself, though, was quiet, where Jack Johnson was somebody who was very brash and very loud. Joe Louis followed a series of rules that his manager laid out, like don't speak unless spoken to, never be photographed with a white woman. Like, these were things that were drilled into Joe Louis's head. But this is what's so interesting about sports and politics. It didn't matter what Joe Louis, the individual, may have felt about civil rights or what have you. It was about what he represented to people, to see an African-American champion at that time, even in a sport as brutal as boxing, and what that meant. Martin Luther King, he tells this story in his book, Why We Can't Wait, and Letter from a Birmingham Jail, where he tells the story of a young man being in the gas chamber in the South. And as the gas comes in and he dies, his last words being, "Save me, Joe Louis, save me, Joe Louis, save me, Joe Louis." And so, you know, that King felt like that this was a story worth telling. I mean, it just says a lot about the role that sports play in people's lives that goes so far beyond the highlights on television and whatnot. But those hidden histories, I think, they're not part of our mainstream political oxygen or atmosphere. I mean, the person on the cover of the book, Muhammad Ali, who I've spent a lot of time studying and writing about, I mean, it's a remarkable, remarkable history. I mean, it's because it's a history of an individual who's probably been written about to exhaustion, but who was both shaped by the 1960s and someone who was a shaper of the 1960s. And it's this fascinating interplay between time and individual. I mean, if you'd asked the young Cassius Clay in 1960 who his hero was as an 18-year-old gold medalist, he would have said that his hero was a professional wrestler named Gorgeous George Wagner. And if the 60s had not have happened, if they'd just been another 50s, you know, he would have been remembered, I think, as the person who brought the showmanship of professional wrestling to boxing. And so that was 1960. But by 1962, by 1964, his name wasn't Cassius Clay anymore. He was going by Cassius X, and his hero was Malcolm X. By 1965, 66, his name was Muhammad Ali, and his hero would have been Elijah Muhammad of the Nation of Islam. But by 1968, and when his title was stripped, when he was banned from boxing, when he was losing all his money hand over fist, and when he was really alone in the world with the exception of his wife at the time, Belinda, he would have said that his heroes would have been the people. That would have been the people who are actually fighting against war in this country, who are fighting for civil rights. And in that magical year of 1968, and this is so often, this is why I think this history is important, it's so often left out of histories of the 60s that you read. He made 200 speeches that year on college campuses, four a week over the course of the year. And he would always end his speeches by saying, remember, his title was stripped without him losing. And so he would always end his speeches by saying, "Can someone take my title without me being whooped?" And all the students would yell, "No!" And he would say, "Who's the champ? Who's the champ?" And they would chant, "Ali, Ali, Ali." And that might sound kind of tame now, but think about it like this. In 1968, when the students were chanting Ali, the New York Times had an editorial policy to not call him Muhammad Ali. Like, he had to be called Cassius Clay in the New York Times. You know, so it was about a dividing line where whether or not you rooted for someone in a boxing match actually said a lot about where you stood on a whole host of issues, from the free speech struggles on campuses to the war to civil rights, all embodied in a fighter. And so there's that history as well. And so that's what I do in the book. And certainly taking that to the next conclusion in speaking about the fight for Title IX and women's rights in the early 1970s was something that was an absolute joy to write, because there's so many people still among us who were part of those struggles for women to have equal access in sports. And as the father of a young daughter, I mean, doing the research on Title IX was something that was a joy to see, like the way that people saw those things as integrated, like the struggle for women's liberation, access to sports, just as the suffragettes did in the 19th century. And, you know, the statistics are really staggering. Like today, one out of three young girls take part in some sort of sports. And before Title IX was passed, that number was one out of 27. So you think about that, one out of three, one out of 27. And according to the research of the Women's Sports Foundation, young girls who are involved in sports are less likely to have eating disorders, less likely to be involved in abusive relationships, less likely to become addicted as teenagers to drugs or alcohol. So you're talking about a reform that was won in the early 70s that's improved the quality of life of tens of millions of women. And the other thing about this reform is that it's something that both George W. Bush and John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, both want to see overturned, by the way. And I'm very happy that it doesn't look like, at least for Bush, that he's going to have the chance to do it. But it says something, though, that it's still something that has to be fought for, that it's still about a question of access. And there are also a lot of problems with Title IX, which, if people have questions about, could be addressed. But the struggle is far from over. But it shows that struggle, in this case, does actually work. So that's I would like to take questions, but I don't know how long I've been talking or whatever. But I do just want to end by just raising the question about why we don't know this history today. Like this is such a sports-mad nation. And so why is it that some of this history of the way politics and sports intersect or intertwined or, frankly, inextricable? Why so much time and energy is spent trying to put them all in their little boxes and keeping the sports fan, I would argue, consciously ignorant of a more radical history? And that's something I think about a lot, and I really come up with three things. The first is that, I mean, sports itself, obviously, just being a trillion-dollar global business, that there's a pressure to take athletes, and I've seen this, and turn athletes into, quote-unquote, brands. Like, you're not a person anymore, you're a brand. Like the Jordan brand, like that's a phrase that marketers use. And so you think about, what does the Jordan brand mean? It means Michael Jordan is what athletes should aspire to be. And not on the court, which, God, everybody would want to aspire to be, but in the marketing realm, which means you are as blank a slate as possible. You have no opinions or ideas about anything. And that means people can sort of project onto you whatever they want you to be. And that's a goal. You want to be like the Jordan brand, and you don't want to limit your marketing appeal by saying anything controversial or political. But the second reason why I think that this so that's one reason. The second reason why I think a lot of these politics aren't known is because pro sports owners, the people who actually control sports, are so far to the right of the rest of this country. I mean, it's like a consciously right-wing political outlook of the people who control sports. That's not every owner to a T, but I'm doing a book right now about owners called Bad Sports. It's the title. And it's crazy. Like, people may have heard that Barack Obama just raised a record $150 million last month. If you look at political donations this campaign cycle by pro sports owners, it's McCain's 6-to-1 ratio. I mean, so out of step with where the rest of the country is. And I'm not saying that as an endorsement of Obama. I'm just saying, like, straight facts. Like, they're McCain people by a 6-to-1 margin. Or when Sarah Palin, that disaster at the insanely named Wachovia Arena at the Flyers game, which was too perfect. I mean, the failing candidate at the failed bank stadium, when Sarah Palin drops the puck and was booed to smithereens by the Philadelphia fans. I mean, the NHL tried to sell the idea that the reason why Sarah Palin was doing it was because she had brought unprecedented attention to the world of hockey. And if you want any reason why hockey is the worst marketed sport in the world, it's thinking Sarah Palin is like, hey, yeah, right. Ka-ching, Sarah Palin will bring in fans. No, not.
Fox News blanked out the booze.
Yes, they did. And the stadium as well, it's worth stating too. Like, there was this weird thing after that, just throwing this out here, is like all the hockey bloggers, these are not political people who were there. All the hockey bloggers, from the New York Times one to the more obscure websites, were like, deafening boos, cascade of boos, insane boos. But the news reports, if you saw the political page, were like, a mixture of cheers and boos. Like, we have to be fair and balanced about this. But I had I co-wrote a story about it with a friend who was there in the arena. And he was like, look, it was booze, it was Obama-Biden signs, and then it was rock music pumped through. So it would seem like more sort of dissonant and obscure. But, oh my goodness. I mean, she also even brought out her 7-year-old daughter wearing a Flyers jersey. And she said beforehand, I'm doing this to avoid getting booed because I know how rough these Philly fans could be. So once again, going for Mother of the Year, Sarah Palin brings out her 7-year-old daughter to get booed with her. I'm telling you. Yeah. Philadelphia fans for the uninitiated, Philly fans famously booed Santa Claus at a Philadelphia Eagles game. And my favorite story, though, is at a Phillies game. Oh, my goodness. The Phillies game, on Easter, they did an Easter egg hunt for the kids of the players. And they asked for a round of applause for the kids who didn't find Easter eggs. And the kids were booed. So it's a rough crowd anyway. But when you sort of tack in the political aspect, it was absolutely brutal. So but she was out there because the owner of the Phillies is the CEO of Comcast, a guy by the name of Ed Snyder, who'd given $25,000 to the campaign. So once again, it's the owners themselves, I think, do a lot to muzzle this history. But the last reason, and then I'll shut up, and if people have questions, that'd be awesome, is because I think it's about disempowering us, disempowering the fan. I mean, creating this idea, which is a very modern idea, which did not exist before this century, where sports had this iron wall between participant and spectator. This idea that we are sort of objective, passive consumers of this process and not people who would actively try to change the process. As fans, not actively trying to say, wait a minute, we love sports, but we hate racism, sexism, militarism that so often travels with sports. We love sports, but we hate the idea that we're giving billionaires $500 million publicly funded parks for the privilege of watching them. I'm sure in D.C. you have no idea what that would feel like to publicly fund a stadium. So there's that aspect of it as well, because I really do believe that armed with history, that's really the best way to move forward and speak concretely about how to reclaim sports. Because to quote Howard Zinn, who wrote People's History of the United States, who of course inspired this book, has Howard Zinn. I always end my talks by saying this because it's so true. He said, I study history not because I want to understand the past, but because I want to change the future. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I'm happy to take any questions if people have them, but I'm also happy to not if people just want to buy tons of books.
Well, I want to thank you for a great presentation, and I have just a quick comment and then a question. My comment is I hope in your new book, the book to come, you will explore Dan Snyder's refusal to change a racist name of his newly owned Washington football team. And my question is, I know many countries around the world have sports and or cultural ministers under which sports is an important part of the country's, patrimony. Do you think if we had something like that, sports might have evolved differently in the U.S.? The late Title IX decisions in the 70s, would things have changed, do you think, if we had something like that?
First of all, I just want you to know I deal with the origin and history of the name Redskins in this book as well, because it's a history that needs to be known for a simple reason, because it's another history that's shrouded in lies. Because I've spoken to the people who run the Redskins and, like, what's up with the name, and their official response, not just to me but to all reporters, is that it's actually a tribute to the Red Clay Indians of the yada, 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 you know, people who would put red clay on their skin for the purposes of battle. And I swear, if you believe that, I totally have this awesome bridge in Brooklyn that I want to sell you. Because the truth is that the person who owned the Redskins was a gentleman by the name of George Preston Marshall. George Preston Marshall was a segregationist. When he moved them to Washington, he changed their name from the Braves, I believe it was the Boston Braves, to the Washington Redskins. And they were the southernmost team in the NFL. And it was a direct way to try to appeal to the South. And he was unapologetic about that. People may know the Redskins fight song. It's like, fight for old D.C. The original lyrics were fight for old Dixie. And they were the last team to integrate in the NFL. So this is – actually, they had to integrate because the Kennedy administration said that they would no longer allow him to play on federal land unless they integrated. So it was practically at a political gunpoint they integrated. Um, so So, yeah, that history's in the book, but I definitely, in the new book, I would want to deal with that as one of Dan Snyder's many transgressions against nature and humanity. And as for the second point about would a minister of sports have helped at some point, well, I'll tell you this. It's very interesting. Like in every country that you see with the origins of professional sports, a kind of national direction to how sports develop. In the United States, that national direction started with industrialists, with private capital, with people like Vanderbilt and Rockefeller. They funded the first YMCAs, the public school athletic leagues, and they did it to create space because there was a deep concern, and I talk about this in the book, about immigrant youth and the kind of influences they were coming under during the great waves of immigrations that took place in the 19th century in this country. Great concerns that they would fall prey to either delinquency or radicalism. And they would talk very openly about this, about sports being a place to tame those instincts. And yet, of course, the space was very male, and it was very white, and it was for European immigrants. So I think that had a distorting effect on sports in this country that's lasted, I mean, frankly, to this day. I mean, particularly with the issue of militarism in sports and the binding of those two things together with that whole era of what's called muscular Christianity. And because that was a very new idea at that time. Before that, sports were seen as something evil, something that would be a deficit to an otherwise great nation and interfere with the destiny of this country, and something that people were actively discouraged to not be involved in sports. And that changed during the mid-late 19th century. So I think that if there was some sense of national direction of sports in this country, that would start at the top. I mean, I think that would be beneficial if it's – but it's all about what its goals would be and how seriously it would be funded. Like, to me, the goal of sports has to start with access and has to start with trying to actually return sports to public education in this country, where it's been ripped away from so many schools at this point, concurrent with a real crisis of childhood obesity in this country. So unless it's going to deal with that at the base level, I that's what I'd be for. Not like Arnold Schwarzenegger when he was head of like the Council on Physical Fitness and under Bush, Bush the Elder. Like, that wasn't serious. Yeah.
I forgot who it was that said this, but it used the Lenin's term as saying that sports is the opiate of the people. And that was way back. I mean, when we had on TV and newspapers and things like that. And it's always been a passion a lot of people. But nowadays, with blogs and with ESPN and TV and people, and also I guess it's related to males not having as high a college rate. They're not going to college as often as women. And fantasy football. And I mean, is it going too crazy? Is it just becoming too much of a drug on the society?
It's an interesting question. I mean, there are a lot of people who say if only people would devote as much time to politics and mental energy as they do to sports, then this country would be a profoundly better place. But when I hear that, I sometimes think to myself, and if only we all had the ability to sprout wings and fly, then we could create world peace. I mean, it's fine to say if onlys, but to me it's about looking at reality, and that this can be a very brutal world, and a lot of people do crave escape. And that's in that regard, I think that sports can be a very healthy outlet for people. Not in every case, obviously, but in many cases, it can be something very healthy for people, and something that people devote their mental energy to, because every other place feels sort of alienated and off. Like, if you don't have control at your job, if you think who's ever in office in terms of politics is just going to screw you anyway, which is something you hear a lot, then sports at least looks like something concrete that you can have some sense of control over. Like, which may not be true, but my starting point to the problem then becomes like, okay, if sports is going to be this engaged space, then how do we fight for that space? Instead of saying, it's all BS, how do we fight then for sports to be something constructive and good in people's lives instead of something that's negative? How can we actually use sports, as some athletes are doing today, as a platform to say something about social change and to use that sounding board, to use that platform? I mean, there's a gentleman on death row in Georgia right now named Troy Davis, who may be executed before the end of this month. And there's just to use that as one example, we can say, isn't it horrible that this man's going to be executed for, most likely an innocent man is going to be executed in Georgia, and yet people are so concerned about the playoffs or the NFL when this injustice is going to occur? But that's one approach, and say it's that people are just drugged out and opiated out. Another approach is to try to maybe go to athletes, and this is something I did with this thing called Jocks for Justice, and get them to sign on to saying we want justice for Troy Davis. And to use the fact that so many people pay attention to sports, well, maybe they'll also learn about Troy Davis through sports, because someone like Jim Brown, the great football player, he signed on to that ad, and he got a bunch of his teammates from those 1960s Browns teams, or Eton Thomas of the Washington Wizards. And then the people who only read the sports page then get to learn something about Troy Davis as well. So it's all right. So it's like you have this esteemed cultural space, and maybe it says something sick about our society that a baseball player makes so much more than a teacher, and people, you hear people say that a lot. But then it's like, okay, well, then how do we then fight for our space and fight for our values and ideals within that space instead of just seeding the ground? I hope that helps answer it.
Hi there. I saw a really interesting documentary recently called Bigger, Stronger, Faster, and the kind of micro issue it deals with. It's not small, but the kind of micro scale issue it deals with is steroid usage and whether it should be legal for in sports, and why when it's not legal is it not? And the larger kind of point it makes is it kind of argues that America is such a competitive place that steroid use is going to be inevitable because we want to be the best and the biggest and the fastest. So I just wanted to hear if you had any thoughts about that larger point or about the just issue of steroid usage in sports in general.
Yeah, I mean, to me, about steroids, and first of all, I'm on steroids right now. I'm just kidding. It's like the question needs to be posed to the fan. Like, do you want to know how the sausages are made or not? I mean, if people don't want to know how the sausages are made, then I think they need to cede from the sort of insane hysteria every time you hear about an athlete testing positive for steroids and actually then look reality in the face and say, why do athletes take steroids? Well, in baseball, for example, you play this grueling 162-game season. Many steroids that are taken are done so for the purposes of trying to heal from injuries, not to actually bulk up. And then it's like, well, where do you then draw the line between science and cheating? I mean, it's a question that I haven't heard answered in a way that makes any sense to me, particularly because so many things that were, for example, legal in the mid-90s, forms of androstenedione, are illegal now. And there are these shifting definitions of legality and illegality. And I also get very tired with the way the finger is always pointed at the athlete. And it's not looked at systemically at all. Like, to stick with baseball, one out of six minor leaguers now come from the Dominican Republic, because the Major League Baseball has invested tens of millions of dollars in the Dominican Republic. Steroids are legal in the Dominican Republic and available over the counter. I mean, does Major League Baseball care about that, or do they turn a blind eye because of that, because they want their players bigger, faster, stronger, et cetera? So the hypocrisy there is really profound. And when you see the politicians on Capitol Hill do these hearings about it, my first thought is always, my God, there has to be something better for them to be doing right now. There just has to be. I mean, granted, if we were living in a world that was just peaceful and affluent and people's needs were met, then I would say, hey, go to town. Have fun. Talk about steroids. But the idea that the same committees that deal with things like federal spending in New Orleans is spending time on this, like the Government Oversight Committee, to me, it just boggles. It boggles the mind. I mean, it makes me think we need oversight of the Government Oversight Committee. One last thing about that, what's also never discussed, I do talk about it in the book here, is that one of the reasons why there's been this explosion of performance-enhancing drugs in sports, this is just the other aspect of it, is that pharmaceuticals were totally deregulated in the early 1990s. And it was done like Bill Clinton and Orrin Hatch, arm-in-arm, with something called DSHEA, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act. And, you know, it sounds really good. Health, education, wow. But all it really meant was that they were opening the door for the FDA to have to prove that certain performance enhancers were harmful, instead of the previous way where the private company had to prove that they were safe. So they switched the whole burden of proof on these pharmaceuticals. So it's like bigger, faster, stronger. To me, the question is access, accountability, and actually putting it to the fans themselves. Like, if we really want to clean this up, then we need to get at the roots of the sport and not think that tearing apart players every few months is going to actually make a difference. So, is it systemic in America? Well, just one last thing about that. Like, until, like Joe DiMaggio once said, and this isn't entirely true, but this thing, Joe DiMaggio once said that he said rich people don't make the major leagues. You have to have a hunger in your belly if you're going to make it. So it's also, as long as you have a situation where people who grow up poor are the primary people who enter professional sports because they're driven enough to do it, and that the question of success or failure, you could just see it on a razor's edge. I mean, then it becomes like, are we really going to moralize and point fingers about people doing whatever they have to do to then make it in the sport? And so to me, I'd much rather see reforms to make sure that it's regulated, that it's safe, that people aren't killing themselves to do it, because so much of it is black market at this point. And, you know, and that it be dealt with rationally like adults and not people crying that Mickey Mantle never took steroids and therefore the whole system is screwed up or whatever. But, you know, Mickey Mantle took his own kind of performance enhancer, which is he got hammered, you know, and it's a different kind of performance enhancer. More an after game performance enhancer than a during the game, but nonetheless, yeah.
Good afternoon. I saw the movie The Express last weekend about, you know, this football player that I'd never heard of before.
Ernie Davis.
Yeah. and I'd never heard of him before, and I liked the movie, and it turns out it's not doing well at the box office, so it's a four-hanky movie, but go see it anyway. And it got me thinking that, you know, most sports movies that, you know, I've seen or I've heard about, they're mostly about men. There are two that I recall, one about Billie Jean King that starred Holly Hunter, but that was a TV movie, and one years before that about Babe Dietrichsing Zaharias, which was also a made-for-TV movie. So I'm wondering, you know, I'm waiting for a movie about the Magnificent Seven, so when is that going to happen?
It's a good question. I would throw in A League of Their Own there, too. Oh, yeah. As a movie, which I thought was actually quite good by the standards of sports movies, which I would argue is a very low standard, because sports movies are like, yeah, I'd like to see that. I mean, that was a telemovie, the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan. A Personal Best is an amazing movie. It's amazing. I'm not a movie expert, but so if people have others to throw out, but Personal Best about women Olympic runners is absolutely incredible. The Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan, I think that needs to be like a big budget Hollywood movie, and not the tawdry. Just because we're about to hit Halloween, I should tell you, the best Halloween costume I ever saw were two women going as Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding. One, like, walking around with a stick, the other with a big knee brace. That was kind of funny, but whatever. Kind of brutal. Not that funny? Okay. But I think there's so much room to do so many more interesting stories. And the problem with sports movies, and this would also be my number one critique of The League of Their Own, actually, is that they – and I heard in the Ernie Davis movie was actually better, The Express was better in this regard, is that there's no sense of context. There's no sense of the real world that's surrounding this. So it's like a lot of the sports books that are unfortunately on the shelves of bookstores around this country, which the athlete is pretty much presented as sort of the love child of John Wayne and Sarah Palin, just sort of like this lone person against the universe, and they got to tackle adversity. And, you know, it's like drenched in machismo and not any sense of history or context, which I think is so all important in actually knowing the history. But I would like to see more movies about women's sports. Documentaries have done a better job of it. There's a fantastic documentary about the U.S. women's soccer team in the late 90s. Yeah, HBO did it, which is fantastic. It was really good. So documentaries have done a better service than Hollywood.
I want to ask about baseball, Dave, because I see baseball. I grew up a baseball fan. I grew up around Fenway, going to Fenway in the late 70s. And one of the things is that baseball – these new stadiums are being built. I don't know anybody who's under 35 who that's their first sport, whereas for me, at 43, it's everybody. So baseball to me, and one of the things that I see as a phenomenon over the last few years is that all the lazy players are either Latinos or blacks. I mean, Manny Ramirez doesn't hustle. Now he's will he go to the Hall of Fame? Doesn't hustle.
I'm sorry, Mark. This is being recorded, so people should know you put lazy in air quotes.
Air quotes.
Just yes. So people know you yes. Weren't calling them lazy.
Health of the lazy.
Just watching your back, Mark. Go ahead.
Thank you. But labeled by their teammates. I remember when Brad Wilkerson, who was hitting about 240 and to me was the most atrocious leadoff hitter for the Nationals, no speed, mediocre defense, lousy hitter, but he was saying Jose Guillen, who was a 300 hitter, was not hustling. And there's other examples, and these guys then go on to other teams, usually on the West Coast in areas that are more acceptable, I guess more liberal cities, what have you. But the and it reminded me as a kid, Jim Rice called Boston a racist city, and I, look at the Red Sox now and don't see much of a change demographically on them. John Rocker, I guess, is the only exception, but how far did he have to go until they got rid of him? And I just wonder. The Rockies last year, I wanted to like them, but then I found out what they were really about, and it's pretty scary stuff. And I'm wondering, what is there's this sort of culture in baseball that is, it's almost this throwback, and there does not seem to be much integration, even though it looks like it on the field. And I don't read anything about it. It's just something I'm observing, and you certainly aren't going to see it in interviews.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wow. Baseball has undergone such a profound, dramatic shift over the last 20 years, which I think mirrors the whole idea of young people not identifying it at the same time, because there's been this massive capital investment in the Dominican Republic, and less so but still very significant in Venezuela, because they can sign players for $1,000 at age 15, and they're not too specific about looking at the birth certificates. 99% don't make it. I wrote an article about this, and I got an angry call from the head of scouting for the Minnesota Twins saying, how dare you say 99% of our players in the Latin American academies don't make it? I said, okay, what's your number? He said 93%. I was like, oh, that's much better. Congratulations. And I feel obliged, but that's just the Twins, let me just say. Because, baseball doesn't lend itself to social justice when it comes to this dynamic, if you think about it. Because, you need to find one all-star, like, say, Miguel Tejada, who's from the Dominican Republic, you need 19 other people. You need to field a whole group of people to see if someone can play baseball. It's not like basketball where someone could walk in and be 7 feet tall, or football where someone could walk in and be 6'8", 350, and you could say, hey, that's a player. No, baseball, you actually need people who end up being just discarded at the end of the process with no money invested in education for these guys, nothing whatsoever. And, Dominican Republic has a poverty rate of 60 to 70%. And Sammy Sosa, he once said, when you grow up in the Dominican Republic, your choice is really, at the end of the day, the shoe factory, the army, or the baseball academy. And sort of feel like those are your life's choices growing up. It makes it actually look like your best shot to literally throw away any other ambition and say, I'm going to fight like hell to make these academies, which is another reason why Latino ball players are called lazy, where I'm just like, do you have any idea what these guys actually had to go through to get from point A to point B? But there's also been a massive cut of the number of African-American players in baseball. It's under 8% now. It was 25% 20 years ago. And it's really quite stark for me, who grew up in New York City watching people like Daryl Strawberry and Dwight Gooden. And the number one reason for that, to me, like just studying it, is it's all about infrastructure. It's all about it costs money to create leagues, to actually have rec centers and things like that. And you're not seeing that in urban areas right now. And so baseball has tried to do something called the RBI program, Reviving Baseball in Our Inner Cities. But Dr. Harry Edwards, sports sociologist, he described it like giving CPR to a dead person at this point. So it's not doing very well. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I had one comment and one question. A previous commenter brought up drugs and sports. Major League Soccer, unfortunately, just experienced its first drug suspensions this past week. Two members of the New York Red Bulls, they were taking... I'm sorry. it was the New York Red Bulls, and they were taking over-the-counter metabolites, not under-the-counter drugs. They were both suspended for 10 games. That's one-third of the season, and they were fined 10% of their salaries. Jeez. So it's a serious business if you look at it that way.
Yeah.
My question is, do you deal in your book with Major League Soccer and the fact that Major League Soccer is an international sport and soccer of the world is an international sport the way baseball isn't? I mean, it's more that any given day you can see a player from anywhere in the world on a pitch. And in the U.S., that generally means Latin America. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you deal with in your book?
I have a whole – first of all, just to say – I mean, my God, the New York Red Bulls. So I guess it would have been okay if they'd chugged 10 Red Bulls before a game. And,
I guess, yes.
but not for taking it over the. It's just. Kurt Schilling. I'm so sorry. I have to say something bad about Kurt Schilling with a Red Sox fan. But Kurt Schilling. I mean, who famously in the World Series, you know, he had the bloody sock, he pitched in all that pain, and you know he's getting shot up with cortisone throughout the game. Yet that's not a performance enhancer. That's totally above ground and legal. But Andy Pettit takes a drug so he can heal, so he doesn't miss a start rotation, and he's held out. He has to cry at a press conference to get over it. And don't get me started on race and steroids too, because that's a whole other question of like Barry Bonds being. You know, absolutely decried from top to bottom as being evil incarnate. And it took Mark McGwire and Roger Clemens having full-scale meltdowns in front of Congress to get equal criticism. But about soccer, I mean, honestly, I don't talk about it a lot in the book, but I wrote a book called Welcome to the Terror Dome where I have a whole chapter on soccer. Whole chapter looking at why it's not popular here but popular over there. How in a sort of... subterranean way, it actually is very popular here. It's the number one youth sport in the United States. I talk about like some of the insane right-wing attitudes about soccer, like some beautiful people from the National Review who speak about soccer as if the Red Army is marching over the Caucasus ready to conquer this country. And so I don't know if their copies of Welcome to the Terror Dome here, but cool. But there's a big, meaty chapter on soccer, which did not make the cut for this book. And that's the number one thing I got to say. Like, this book was, like, twice as thick, and I had to – a lot of chop, 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 because there were a certain number of pages. So I hope that people buy it, because then maybe we could do a volume two.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.